right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. That's right, the Michael Slate Show. We have a very special show today, one I've been waiting to do again for a long time. Actually, we had this guest on the show last year, and it was quite a pleasure, and he's got a new book out, and I'm really, really happy to welcome him to the show. We're going to spend the hour talking with Richard Dawkins, ethologist and evolutionary biologist, author, science educationer. He should educate me on how to talk, science educator and humanist. And our conversation is going to center on his latest book, The Magic of Reality, How We Know What's Really True. Richard, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Sure. And I should tell people that we're talking to you live from the Detroit Zoo. What the hell are you doing there?
That's a magnificent place. I had no idea. This is a really splendid zoo. And we had a nice introduction from the director. They have a wonderful policy of treating the animals or sort of the way the animals want to be treated. And so, for example, when the vet wants to come in and take blood or something, the animals are trained to come along and present their tail so that the vet can take the blood from them. So it's all done by training, and the animals are encouraged to volunteer rather than being coerced. So it's a wonderful zoo.
You know, I had a distant cousin named Bobo who lived there for a while.
Oh, yes?
Yeah, he was kind of a rebel. He didn't fit in. I don't know what happened. But, okay. All right. But anyway, I'm really glad to hear that. It sounds like a very fascinating place to be. And Detroit has been actually Michigan has been quite an adventure for you. You had a talk scheduled, and the guy at the last minute decided to cancel the venue?
That was a bit of a scandal. It was a country club, the Windgate Country Club. The whole episode's being referred to now as Windgate Gate. This man, he apparently didn't know anything about me or my book, and he was watching, of all people, Bill O'Reilly. Here is a man who gets his facts from Bill O'Reilly. And I didn't think anybody took their facts from Bill O'Reilly.
Well, it could be the Windbag Gate, then.
Yeah, that's just the Windbag Gate. Excellent, yes. So anyway, he saw me on Bill O'Reilly. But by the way, I hardly got a word in edgeways with Bill O'Reilly, which is not an uncommon experience. But anyway, he decided that he didn't want me in his country club. So he cancelled a long-standing engagement for a large dinner in my honor, I suppose, in a way, at the country club. And the organizers had to scramble around to find another venue, which they did, much to their credit, and much to the credit of the alternative venue as well. But it is actually rather a shocking example of bigotry, and I am not a particularly virulent, militant sort of person. I'm quite civilized. I sort of wear a suit and a tie and talk in a fairly kind of civilized way. To actually ban me, cancel an entire event because he doesn't like my views on the universe, the cosmos, the origin of all things, I don't know much about First Amendment to the Constitution, but I should have thought it was a pretty straight down the line violation of it.
Richard, this is America. We know what we want, what we know, and we don't care whether it's right or wrong. We just know it, okay?
So, okay,
don't
it.
Forget that. All right, let me tell people a little bit about your book. It's a really incredible book. It's The Magic of Reality, How We Know What's Really True. And it's really an incredibly, I have to tell you, Richard, it's a beautiful book, both in terms of its content, but also you've done something very different here where you have it illustrated by Dave McKean. And the illustrations are just such a remarkable, remarkable addition to it. And what you've done here, you know, in terms of both the poetry of the magic that you talk about in terms of the real world, but also what the beauty and poetry that these illustrations bring, it's just a tremendous combination. How did you hit on that? Why did you do the book this way? And why did you do this book in particular now?
Well, I've long wanted to do a book for young people. My target age was about 12, but I think actually it goes up to any age, up to, 106. And Dave McKean, you're right, he's a spectacularly good artist, and his pictures are ideally suited to the text. In particular, each chapter, before I get onto the science, begins with myths. So, for example, there's a chapter on what is the sun, and we begin with myths about the sun. There's a chapter on what is a rainbow, and we begin with myths about the rainbow. And Dave McKean's pictures of the myths are really gorgeous because he gets into the spirit of the ethnicity of the myth concerned, whether it's Australian Aboriginal or West African or Aztec or ancient Egyptian. The pictures really resonate with the original culture that produced the myths. And then that's only the beginning part of each chapter. Then, of course, we go into the science. What really is the sun? What really is a rainbow? What really is an earthquake? And there his pictures change to being scientific illustrations, of course.
Now, I'd have to add, too, I think actually I know what you were saying about your target audience, but I really think it's true that, look, I learned quite a bit from this book, and including in terms of how to look at the world, you know, in a certain sense, in terms of a scientific approach to the world. Because I think in addition to explaining things, this book, for people of all ages, frankly, you really help people with the understanding of how to look at the world scientifically. What does this mean? Is there beauty in science and whatnot? And I think this is what really comes out in your book. You've explained things to me, and I'm not really, you know, Bobo was the one that was in the zoo. I actually, you know, I actually had a degree in biology. I studied molecular biology, organic chemistry, you know, and I've done all this. And I learned quite a bit, you know, I've really had a passion for science over the, you know, throughout my life. But I learned quite a bit in the approach that you took to this book. So I think it's really important. And you do begin with a whole section on epistemology, on why and how we know things, how we know things and why it's important. Can you talk about why you did that?
Yes, well, first, thank you for your very kind words, and I'm delighted that you reacted in that way. I hasten to say I don't use the word epistemology. It's not a word that would go down with the audience very well, I think. But as you say, it's about how we know what's what, and what is reality, and how do we know about reality. And, well, it seemed to be important to get that across at the beginning, and I talk about how fundamentally what we're using is the senses, but of course the senses are aided by instruments like microscopes and telescopes and so on, and also we are aided by more indirect scientific methods, building models, putting forward hypotheses which you can then test by looking at their predictions. And so quite a lot of what we know about science, for example how we know about the structure of DNA, was gathered by postulating a model of DNA, well, several different models of DNA, and then looking to see whether they fit the facts. And if they do, then you increase your confidence that the model actually is real. And in the case of DNA, our confidence is total, that the model is correct. It is indeed a double helix. But that was never discovered by directly watching, by directly seeing the double helix. It was all done by saying, well, suppose it was a double helix, what would we see through our instruments?
Now, you also make the argument that, and I think it's an important one, which was that, look, there's reality consists of definite things, and there's things that we know that are part of reality, that we discover that are part of reality, and there's things that we don't know that are also just as much a part of reality, and things that we maybe won't know for a million years, but they're still a part of reality. And you use the example, I thought, which is really good. You have a way of going deep into the tiny world as well as the gigantic world, and that's showing these things that we have no ability through our senses on one level to, or even through instruments that aid our senses, we don't have an ability today to actually know everything that exists. But reality has sort of this gigantic, you know, storehouse of things that make it up, that whether we know it or not.
Well, absolutely. And it's one of the important things about science, one of the most important things to get across, is that we don't know everything. We are uncertain. Scientists thrive on their uncertainty. They love it because it gives them something to do. And we can look forward, probably, I suspect, to centuries of future science where we will learn more and more, well, not we, because most of us won't be here, but where scientists will learn more and more, and it will become more and more exciting, and more we will be approaching a total understanding. But we're very far from that at the moment, and we need to know it. We need to broadcast the fact that there's plenty that we don't know, plenty for young people to find out if they go into a career in science. And I like to think that some of the people who read my book, who knows, they may turn out to be future Darwins or future Einsteins.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you this, because, you know, you also say in here, and I think it's important, that I want to follow up a little bit on this point you make about science thriving on the unknown, and how that actually, it, the approach of science to the unknown, and the idea that this opens doors. And you contrast that very sharply with the supernatural, the kind of magic that you describe as supernatural magic. And you make a very, very sharp statement about the not only the paucity of supernatural explanations, but the actual damage that supernatural explanations do. And you contrast that to actually, you know, the scientific approach of thriving on the unknown.
Well, very much so. I mean, supernatural explanations are lazy and cowardly. Because what it amounts to is you say, well, there's something we don't understand. I don't understand how this happens. Therefore, I'm going to say it's supernatural. Therefore, I'm going to say it's magic. And that is cowardly, as I say, and lazy and defeatist. The right approach is to say, here is something we don't understand. Let's go to work on it. Let's roll up our sleeves. Let's try to understand how it works. Maybe the first thing we should do is check the observations to make sure they really that the puzzling observation really did happen. And sometimes it's mistaken. But if we can check the observation and decide that it really did happen, then we may have to modify our science. That's how science progresses. That's the brave way to approach it. The cowardly way, the defeatist way, is to say, well, I don't understand it, so I'm going to chalk it up to the supernatural.
We're speaking with Richard Dawkins about his new book, The Magic of Reality, How We Know What's Really True, and we're speaking live from the amazing, wonderful Detroit Zoo. Now, Richard, you know, as you're saying that, you also make this point, and I thought this was really important for people to get. Again, it's not just the laziness, but there's actual real harm that advocating or explaining things in some supernatural with some supernatural explanation, because in reality, it not only says we can't really explain it in reality, but it blocks the pursuit of an explanation.
That's right. It acts as an actual barrier to pursuing the further explanation. It acts as a sort of inhibitor. It means that people don't bother to do the science because they're satisfied with what seems like an explanation, but if you look at it a little bit more carefully, clearly it's not an explanation at all. It's not an explanation to say, oh, it's magic, oh, it's a miracle, oh, it's supernatural. I once satirized this by imagining Hodgkin and Huxley, who were the two scientists who discovered how the nerve impulse works. It's a major piece of scientific work for which they shared the Nobel Prize. And I imagined Hodgkin saying to Huxley, I say, Huxley, this is a terribly difficult problem, isn't it? And Huxley says, yes, Hodgkin, it's frightfully difficult. Why don't we just give up and say it's supernatural? That is exactly what supernatural explanations are. They are damaging, they get in the way of understanding, and they don't help our understanding in any way whatsoever. They're educationally damaging, and they're damaging to anybody who really wants to be a whole human being. And part of being a whole human being is to understand the nature of existence and the nature of the world in which we live.
Exactly. And I was thinking about the major controversies that erupted around the Large Hadron Collider. And I was thinking about that in terms of the models, the approach of models, developing models and running them out and seeing what should happen, predicting what should happen and then testing it. And I was thinking this whole thing of like all of the opposition to that, and yet the approach of that related to the question of science thriving on the unknown, because the most recent thing they were talking about in terms of particle physics, they were saying, look, we have one more particle that we really have to find that could actually say, okay, our model is correct. And if we don't find it, it might say that our model isn't correct, but our approach will be very, very different. And it was, what, the Higgs boson or something like that?
The Higgs boson, yes.
Yeah. And you know, to me, it really struck me when I was reading your point about the supernatural explanations and the harm they do and the science thriving on the unknown and that whole controversy and the push of scientists around the Large Hadron Collider and the importance of that.
I visited the establishment in CERN where the Large Hadron Collider now is. And I must say it was one of the most moving experiences of my life, comparable to visiting the great telescopes in California and comparable to contemplating the Human Genome Project. These are magnificent feats of human enterprise and cooperation. They, all of them, make me proud to be a member of the human species. And this is real humanity. This is the best of humanity. Now, of course, installations like the Large Hadron Collider are immensely expensive, and so some people object to them on economic grounds. They'd rather spend the money on something else. One could have said the same thing, say, of space exploration. And, of course, economic priorities have to be set, and money spent on one thing could have been spent on something else. But I do think that enterprises such as space exploration, such as the Large Hadron Collider, such as the Hubble telescope and its possible successor, these are really, really worthwhile things. They really elevate humanity to something that we can all rejoice in.
You know, one of the things too that I really agree with that, and I think it goes back to that thing that Keith said about truth is beauty, beauty truth. And you know, I was wondering, even when you mentioned this thing about a lot of times people or not people do it sort of spontaneously, I think broadly, you know, it becomes the conventional wisdom.
But I think it also comes out from the people who hold the purse strings a lot or who run society, the idea that the only thing good to pursue in science or anything else is if it has an immediate use. And I think one of the things that you bring out in your book, and I'd like to get your feeling about this, but what came out of it to me was the idea that sometimes it's just important to know the world because that's the way the world is, and it's important to know the world, whether you can make immediate use of it or not. For instance, when you did the thing about tectonic plates and earthquakes, I live in Los Angeles, you know? And so, you know, and for a large part of my life since I've been here, I came from the East Coast. I never was in an earthquake. I came out here and it rumbles all, you know, not all the time, but every now and then enough to shake you up. And, you know, to tell you the truth, I didn't really know much about tectonic plates, and I was still, you know, and I'll confess to this, there was a part of me that was still looking at earthquakes as like some big angry giant shaking the rug. There's an importance not just for me to understand what's real so I can understand what to do, but also to understand actually the motion of the planet as a thing in itself, you know, and there's a beauty to that, an importance to that.
Yes. My book has a chapter on earthquakes, as you've said, and that actually has the app has a simulation, a computer simulation of an earthquake in Los Angeles as it happens. The chapter, of course, goes on to talk about plate tectonics, as you say. Now, this is one of the major achievements of science in the 20th century. When I was an undergraduate, it was still controversial whether the continents drifted. And during my lifetime, it has become absolutely cast iron scientific fact. It's not just the continents that drift, it's great plates. The entire surface of the globe is made up of interlocking plates, much of the area of which is under the sea, and the continents are just the high uplands on these tectonic plates. And the tectonic plates are moving. They're moving all the time, such that, remarkably, South America once fitted snugly under the bulge of Africa. And if you look, as people have for a long time, and notice that the coastline, the east coast of South America and the west coast of Africa actually do fit very well. And once upon a time, they literally did fit snugly together. And they've been drifting apart for hundreds of millions of years. And somebody calculated they've been drifting apart at the speed with which fingernails grow. Now, of course, they don't just move like fingernails do very, very slowly all the time. They move in jerks and then stay still for a while, then move in another jerk. But the average speed is the speed with which fingernails grow. But the jerks are earthquakes or cause earthquakes. And those earthquakes often cause, if they're under the sea, often cause tsunamis with tremendous destructive force. So this is a fascinating and very important piece of science that has grown entirely in living memory. But you were right when you said that it's a shame if science is taught only from the point of view of what's immediately useful, or if scientific research is done only from the point of view of what's immediately useful. That's a terribly narrow way of looking at science. You have to look at the big picture. You have to look at fundamental science, work out what's actually going on, and the useful parts will follow from that.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Richard Dawkins about his new book, The Magic of Reality, How We Know What's Really True. You know, Richard, one of the things that comes out, I think it's, which is really interesting, again, this point of sort of science and its approach to the unknown. And you do a thing in here, in one of the chapters of your book, where you actually talk about who was the first person. And you say it's hazy, but you have a really unique and I think a really enjoyable and, you know, a teachable thing in there, in the sense of lining up all the photos of from your grandfather to your, you know, 185 million great-grandparents back. And you do this whole progression. And I think it really is an illustration of, you talk about how change is gradual, but then there's actually, when you look at from the beginning to the end, there's this massive leap. You know, in the beginning you're a fish, at the end you're a human. You know, it's sort of like, not you, but your relatives. Yeah. And this was one thing that Bobo got thrown out of the zoo for, because he kept arguing about that too. He didn't believe that. So, but anyway, the other thing in that, though, is that you, in the middle of all that, you make the point that there's a difference when you go, you can't really see the difference on either side of any one photo. But there is a point where you get the difference between Homo sapiens and Homo erectus. And you make a point that there's something, that there's a gap there. There's something that happened. You know, Homo sapiens could not mate with Homo erectus and produce offspring, that at least offspring that could themselves reproduce. So there's the question there. And the approach of the religious people is to start chanting about the God of the gap, you know. And the approach of science is very different. Can we talk about that? Because it does leave things hazy, but you also identify there is a certain gap there.
Well, this is a very interesting point, and it's one that a lot of people have trouble with. As you say, I imagine piling a whole lot of photographs on top of each other, and at one end of the pile of photographs is us, and the other end is a fish. But I also make the point there actually aren't any gaps. There are no gaps at all. There is no gap between Homo erectus and Homo sapiens. If we could get in a time machine and go back to the time of Homo erectus, say 1.5 million years ago, then we would not be able to mate with them, probably. So we would say that they are different species. But the intermediates all along the way could all have mated with each other, with their immediate neighbors in the series. So we could mate with our ancestors of 10,000 years ago. They could mate with their ancestors of 10,000 years ago. They could mate with their ancestors of 10,000 years ago, and so on. So each step of the way back 10,000 years, they could always mate with each other. They would be members of the same species. But if you go back, say, 2 million years or 1.5 million years, we would not be able to mate with them. So there is no gap. It's all gradual. But if you jump a sufficiently large distance into the past, then you're going to find creatures that we couldn't mate with. And of course, jumping 300 million years into the past, you come to a fish. And of course, we couldn't mate with a fish. But I do make the point that every single animal that's ever lived has been of the same species as its parents and its children. So there's never, ever been a gap. Hmm. But if we sample at sufficiently long intervals of time, then we see what appears to be a gap. It's rather like when a child grows up. A child is a baby, and it becomes a toddler, and it becomes a child, and it becomes a teenager, a young adult, middle-aged adult, old adult. But there's never a gap. Nobody ever goes to bed, say, as a middle-aged person and wakes up as an old person.
Hey, I did.
It doesn't happen like that.
I did, Richard. It was really a shock. At least I feel that way a great percentage of the time. Well, this is actually really important because, you know, that, and again, as I said, look, you know what? Once again, your book and how much it can reveal and teach people. And in fact, with me, because when I read that, and actually, as you say that, I remember you saying that, okay, you know, exactly what you said about all along the line, the offspring of the previous one can, you know, the parents and grandparents are the same species as their offspring. And it's important because it is sort of, I think this is a way that evolution is always attacked, and it's always attacked from the right and from the Christian right in particular, but a lot of religious groupings that offer this thing up of, well, in a gap, a supposed gap, there is God. And, you know, and I think even the approach that you've taken around this is the exact opposite. Now, I want to ask you another question here, though, because it's also true, and this really tripped me out. This was the idea that we are related to everything. We're all interrelated. I mean, everything on the planet, you know, from plants, animal life, bacteria, everything. And it really gives you a sense of this, you know, and you could say, oh, well, this is like the hippie ethic or something, or the ethos of some other time. But it's actually really important in terms of, I think, even people developing an ethos for the future is that we are all interrelated, everything on the planet. And you then talk about the vast spectrum of creatures on the planet. And you talk about how that developed. And I'd really like to trip out on that a little bit because you even compare the resemblance between language evolution and species evolution. Can we talk about how this spectrum of creatures developed?
Yes. Well, the reason why we know that we're all cousins is that the genetic code is virtually identical throughout all living creatures, animals, plants, fungi, bacteria. Almost without an exception, the genetic code, which is a 64-word dictionary, is identical, and that proves really beyond all reasonable doubt that we're all cousins, we're all descended from a single common ancestor. If there were other origins of life, then they've died out. All existing creatures are cousins. And if we had a complete fossil record, if there were no gaps, if every creature that had ever lived was preserved in some huge museum, then we would see a continuous chain running between every creature and every other creature. For example, the chain between us and chimpanzees, we would need to go back about 6 or 7 million years to our common ancestor with chimpanzees, and then go forward down the line towards chimpanzees. So there would be a continuous chain linking us to chimpanzees. And every step of the way, the individuals could mate with each other and have fertile offspring. We can't mate with chimpanzees, but we can mate with, if they were still around, our ancestors who could mate with their ancestors, who could mate with their ancestors, who could mate with the common ancestor of chimpanzees, who could mate with their descendants, who could mate with their descendants, who could mate with their descendants, who could mate with modern chimpanzees. And you can do that same trick for any pair of animals you like. Hedgehogs and squirrels, kangaroos and tuna, badgers and octopus. Any pair of animals you like, you can make a continuous series going back to the ancestor and then forward to the other one. So if all the intermediates were still alive, we would just be one great big smear of animals. Perhaps fortunately, they're not still alive, and so it's possible for us to give separate names to different species of animals, and we're used to treating them as though they really are separate. And they are separate as far as living animals is concerned, but if we were to go back, if all their ancestors had happened to survive, if, say, we found ancestors of ourselves and chimpanzees still surviving in the African jungle, then there would be a continuous set of intermediates, and we would have to, if we wanted to make laws discriminating against other animals and in favor of humans, for example, abortion laws or something of that sort, then we would have to do it in a very artificial way, perhaps have courts of law to decide whether such and such an intermediate counted as human, rather like in apartheid South Africa. They had courts to decide whether somebody counted as white.
All right, Richard, we're going to take a quick break and come right back, but I want to pursue this a little bit more, especially in terms of how did all these species develop? And I think that's an important point you make in your book, and I'd like to do that. We're going to take a quick break for about a minute or so and be right back. So stay tuned for a continued conversation with Richard Dawkins, the evolutionary biologist, ethologist, author, and science educator, and humanist. And we're talking about his new book, The Magic of Reality. We'll be right back.
Well, I saw the thing coming out of the sky. It had one long horn and one big eye. Like a Mr. Shaking in the city. It looks like a purple people eater to me. It was a one-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater.
One-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater.
A one-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater. Sure looks strange to me.
One-eyed.
Well, he came down to earth and he lit in a tree. I said, Mr. Purple People Eater, don't eat me. I heard him say in a voice so gruff,
I wouldn't eat you, 'cause you're so tough.
It was a one-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater.
One-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater.
One-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater. Sure looks strange to me.
One horn?
I said, Mr. Purple People Eater, what's your line? He said, eating purple people, and it sure is fine. But that's not the reason that I came to land.
Get a job in a rock and roll band.
Well, bless my soul.
All right, the Purple People Eater from Sheb Woolley. Welcome back. Richard Dawkins, that was inspired off of your book, okay?
That was a lovely song. I love that song.
Yeah, you and me both, you know, and people our age who hear that immediately start singing it, I think. It was great. And that's another reason why animals develop and creatures develop, because they want to get it. And we'll talk about this a little bit later. The possibility of life on other planets and the search for what? A job in a rock and roll band. Okay. So let's pursue this a little bit. The development of all kinds of species and the role of separation, isolation, islands, and natural selection and how that all plays together.
Yes, well, the question you raise is, of course, how you can get divergence in evolution, how it can be that if we all come from one common ancestor, which we certainly do, we manage to diverge to produce the enormous variety of animals, of plants, and, by the way, microorganisms are much more diverse. Most of the variation among life forms on this planet is in microorganisms, and then animals and plants are just two little side branches each. So how does it happen? Well, in animals that reproduce sexually, organisms that reproduce sexually, it usually happens when an ancestral species splits to form two daughter species, or one daughter species branches off an ancestral species. And this usually happens with some kind of initial geographical separation. This is why islands are so important, and not just islands in the normal sense of land surrounded by water, but islands in the more general sense of, say, water surrounded by land, or an oasis surrounded by desert, or a mountaintop surrounded by lowland. So any animal which can survive on land, say, but not in water, just occasionally by accident, a small part of the population may get, say, blown off course, may get transported by some kind of freak accident, like a raft of driftwood or something of that sort, to another island. And when the animals get out on the other island, this has actually been observed with lizards, iguanas, in the West Indies, for example, when they land on the new island, they find themselves isolated from the population on the old island, and so their further evolution can be in a separate direction, which it usually is. And after a bit, they diverge sufficiently far that they become a separate species, which is no longer capable of breeding with the original population if they should happen to meet them again, which they very often ultimately do. And so it's this accidental, rare drifting across from island to island, or from lake to lake, or from mountaintop to mountaintop, which is responsible for at least a large number of the divergences that we see in evolution. So once upon a time, there must have been an ancestor of humans and all other vertebrates, and an ancestor of snails and all other mollusks. And they must have been members of one species. Once upon a time, there was a species which was the common ancestor of all vertebrates, including humans and all mollusks, including snails, and by the way, lots of other animals as well, like insects. And part of that population somehow got separated out from the other part, and one half of the population was eventually destined to give rise to the vertebrates after an incredibly long time, and another half of the population was eventually destined to give rise to the mollusks and the insects and the spiders and so on. So it is a remarkable thought that this process of divergence of an ancestral species, often through getting separated on different islands or different sides of a river, different sides of a mountain range, different oases, something like that, that is what ultimately is the ancestral event which led to the separation between any animal you like and any other animal you like.
Now, this next question sort of spans a couple of chapters in your book, beginning with what things are made of. And you know, it's and going all the way through the question of the seasons, day and night, to the sun and the need for stars. And it comes down to this. My son actually once posed to me what he described as a block he has around agreeing with me about evolution. You know, he says he can see it as a process, but in terms of the initiating factor, he can't. He's just blocked around the legitimacy of evolution in terms of the process of how where life came from. And he says his question he posed was, can life come from non-life? And I think you speak to this very movingly and very convincingly in this book across a number of chapters. Can we talk about that a bit?
Well, life certainly did come from non-life, and it only had to happen once. Maybe it happened more than once, but I doubt it. It only had to happen once. It possibly was an extremely rare event, an extremely improbable event. We don't know how it happened. As I say, it did only happen once, and it happened a very long time ago, perhaps about 4 billion years ago, somewhere around that, certainly earlier than 3.5 billion years and later than 4.6 billion years, because that's when the Earth started. So at some point, this happened, and there are plenty of people, mostly chemists, working on the problem. It's a little bit hard to work on it because conditions have certainly changed since those days, and as I say, it might have been a very improbable event, and so unlikely to be replicated in the lab. But if I could just come back to the earlier discussion we were having, to say that anybody has trouble understanding how the origin of life arose, that's fine, we have trouble understanding, but we should always go from that to say, okay, let's think about it, let's work on it, let's admit that we don't know, but don't let's resort to the cowardly strategy of simply saying, oh, well, we don't understand this, so it must be supernatural. I mean, that really is an absurd response to the mystery. The right response to a mystery is to say, yes, we have a mystery, let's work on it. Until we've found the answer, we're going to have to say we don't know, but there's nothing wrong with that. It's a good thing to say we don't know, because it tells us what to work on. The one thing you must never do is give up, lie down under the problem, and say, oh, it must be supernatural.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually the point about it. It's a question of opening a door or shutting a door, which is something that you keep making over and over again in your book, which I think is very, very important for people to get. You know, so, you know, one thing in terms of this life coming from non-life, one of the things I learned in your book was the role of supernovas and the poetry of We Are Stardust.
Yes, that's right. Well, it's not just life, of course. It's all the elements of which we're made. I mean, the most common element in the universe is hydrogen, and all the other elements are ultimately made by the fusion of hydrogen and then fusion of larger molecules. So hydrogen fuses to make helium. Helium fuses to make larger molecules, which fuse to make larger molecules, and so on. So all the molecules that we're made of come ultimately from hydrogen. And the place where this happens, at least the larger molecules, is in supernovas, gigantic explosions, which are very, very rare. I think they only come once every few centuries in any one galaxy, but of course there are lots of galaxies. And so the elements of which we are made, the elements of which our planet is made, which include things like iron, nickel, aluminum, silicon, carbon, phosphorus, nitrogen, oxygen, these familiar elements which make up the bulk of our bodies, all originally came from explosions in supernovas, which created gigantic dust clouds, which eventually condensed to form spinning disks, which eventually condensed to form stars and planets rotating around those stars. The physicist Lawrence Krauss has poetically made the point that there may be atoms in your left hand which came from a different supernova from the atoms in your right hand. What a stunning thought that
is. Wow, yeah, really. On that note, let me remind listeners that you're tuned in to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Richard Dawkins about his new book, The Magic of Reality, How We Know What's Really True. Now, Richard, one of the things that also comes out that I think is – it kind of swept over me as I was reading your book. The incredible – and I know this is – I've known this before, but it just really came down to something that really just dropped down over my head. The huge element of chance – and randomness involved in us even being here, you know, the question of the sun being exactly what it is, the distance of the Earth from the sun and everything else. There seems to be just this incredible randomness that I knew it and understood it before, but I think what you brought to that was really a deeper understanding of the role of random and chance and the rest of this. But then it also, there's also something else going on too.
Well, we don't know how many planets are suitable for life. We're getting an idea that the number of planets in the universe as a whole is extremely large. Most stars probably have planets. Probably only a minority of planets have even the minimal conditions necessary to make life. It could be that only a tiny minority of them have it. Maybe even our planet may even be the only planet in the universe that has life, although I gravely doubt that. But if it is the only planet in the universe that has life, then we should not be surprised that it is our planet, because here we are contemplating it. So obviously, since we're here, we had to be on a planet that was capable of producing life, orbiting a star that was capable of supporting life, etc. So that's the so-called anthropic principle. We have to be on a planet, we have to be in a universe capable of producing life. We simply don't know how lucky that is. We don't know whether there are lots and lots of planets that have life, or whether this is the only one, or, as I suspect, somewhere in between. So the amount of luck that led to there being life on this planet probably is very large, but not ridiculously large, would be my guess. But then, of course, the luck that led to the existence of our species, and indeed that led to the existence of the mammals and led to the existence of the vertebrates, each of those steps was no doubt an extremely lucky step. Just to contemplate the luck that led to your own existence, your father and your mother had to meet, so did your grandparents, so did your great-grandparents, etc. Not only did they have to meet, they had to copulate on a particular day, and a particular sperm had to be involved in order to produce you. A different sperm would have produced somebody else. It's a quite staggering stroke of luck. The novelist Aldous Huxley wrote a poem about it, which I think I can probably give you by heart. He said, "A million million spermatozoa, all of them alive, out of their cataclysm, but one poor Noah dare hope to survive. And of that billion minus one might have chanced to be Shakespeare, another Newton, a new Donne. But the one was me. Shame to have ousted your betters thus, taking ark while the others remained outside. Better for all of us, froward homunculus, if you'd quietly died. So any one of us, if a different sperm had fertilized the egg, might have turned out to be another Shakespeare, another Newton. And it didn't. It was us. And the same stroke of luck happened to our father and our mother, to all four of our grandparents, to all eight of our great-grandparents, and so on. So we are monumentally lucky to be here. I've sometimes fantasized that a certain dinosaur had only to sneeze in the Jurassic era, for example, to have completely changed the course of history, such that the ancestor of all the mammals, say, was eaten instead of escaping or something of that sort. And so the whole of the mammals might owe their existence to something as random as a dinosaur sneezing. Now, of course, that's total fantasy, but you get the idea that we are the product of a prodigious stroke of luck. But having said that, that doesn't mean that there wouldn't have been something very like the mammals that would have evolved. I suspect it would. Similarly, there might even have been something rather like humans that would have evolved. But it wouldn't be us, and it certainly wouldn't be you and me.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you also, and you're getting right to this. You point out in the book that, you know, again, this point about this, the role of luck and everything else in this. But at the same time, the approach of science where, okay, given all that, we can understand all that luck, but we can also explain why, what conditions were here on this planet and in the universe at the time, or what developed, how it developed, the sun, all this stuff, the actual positioning of the Earth in its orbit in relation to the other planets that orbit the sun. You know, all of that we can explain, and that can give us the best understanding of that there was the conditions created for this. And I think that goes along with, you know, what you're saying, which is a really fascinating and really trippy way to get into this. You also say, too, and I think this is extremely important, that if you were forced to answer, you would say, yes, there probably is life somewhere on another planet, and actually maybe even on millions of planets. And given the number of planets and galaxies that are in the universe, and that you say, but one thing we have to be very careful about is not getting stuck on life as we know it when we're searching for life.
That's right, because, of course, we only know one kind of life. And as I said, our kind of life is all cousins. We're all descended from the same ancestor. We all have the same genetic code. And one could imagine a form of life which was very different, not based on DNA, maybe not even based on carbon, although that seems rather unlikely. But there could be extremely different forms of life which would test our imagination to breaking point. On the other hand, we can look at sort of natural experiments that happened on this planet. For example, when the dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago, the way was left open for the mammals to evolve and step into their shoes, which they did rather rapidly. It took about 5 million years to produce a complete range of mammals to kind of fill all the niches that the dinosaurs had left. But this happened separately in different parts of the world that were isolated in Australia, in South America, in Africa, in Madagascar, in Asia, and so on. And so in each of these separate places, the mammals rapidly evolved and to fill the shoes of the dinosaurs and evolved in parallel, so that in Australia, for example, the marsupials produced animals that pretty much resembled those in Asia or in America. They produced the equivalent of flying squirrels, flying phalangers, marsupials, but they look and behave just like flying squirrels. They produced pouched mice. They produced pouched moles. Not real moles, but they live underground and they behave like moles, and they look like moles. So we can get a sort of idea that when evolution is rerun, when the experiment of evolution is rerun in different areas independently, you tend to get not identical results, but sort of similar results. And that's kind of reassuring, that we can look at one form of life and guess that maybe other forms of life might not be that different. And we can also look around the animal kingdom at things like eyes. Now, eyes have evolved independently. We know it's independently because we know the family tree of life. Eyes have evolved independently more than a dozen or two dozen, three dozen times. So, and to various different designs, which physicists understand, like camera eyes, compound eyes, even reflector eyes, parabolic reflector eyes. So that might give us some confidence that if we were to go to other planets and find life, they might well have eyes, even if it's not DNA-based life, even if the system of genetics is different. They might have eyes, because eyes are such useful things to have. And there are only so many ways to build an optical piece of equipment. That's why cameras are so like eyes. So we're not completely in the dark about speculating about life on other planets. We can do some sort of informed scientific speculation, but we should be very cautious nevertheless.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have two more questions I want to ask you, and we have probably about 8 minutes to do it, maybe about that, maybe a little bit more. But I wanted to ask you this, and this sort of is related to the rest of your book, but it steps out a little bit from it too, and that is the chapter you have on why do bad things happen. I was fascinated by that because, you know, you always hear things. I mean, look, the conventional wisdom is, you know, karma. You got, yeah. You know, and even people who are not religious will say, well, you know, look, man, I must have done something to deserve, you know, the whole what happens to you, or, you know, somebody wins the lottery and, oh, yeah, they really had that coming. They deserve to win that, or any of this other stuff that was going on which really posits some sort of other force other than reality at work here. And I think it's something that really – it's good things happen, bad things happen. You deserve it. You don't deserve it, things like that. Can you talk about that? Because you have a whole different approach to that.
Well, that of course, it's all nonsense about deserving and natural justice and things – like that. There are many people who feel that when you've had a run of bad luck, you're due for a run of good luck. Or there are people who even believe that some people are good at winning the toss in cricket, in the game of cricket. It's very important who wins the toss, because who gets to bat first makes a big difference. And so the captains toss a coin, and whoever wins the toss gets to choose whether to bat first or not. Now, there are seriously people who believe that some captains are better at winning the toss than others. And the whole point about tossing a penny is that it's random. And if some people happen to have a lot of luck in winning the toss, that's not because they're lucky. It's just pure chance. But a lot of people think it is. A lot of people think almost the reverse, that if, say, they're playing roulette and the ball has been coming up red for a long run, that it must be black's turn now, because the law of averages says, oh, on average, it should be an equal number of red and black. So if there's been a long run of red, surely the chance of black coming up goes up. It absolutely does not. And, of course, when you think about it, you realize that. But it is important. Another version, another thing I discuss in the chapter, is so-called Sod's Law or Murphy's Law. People believe that things happen deliberately bad. So when you drop a piece of toast and marmalade, it always falls marmalade side down. That's Sod's Law. That's Murphy's Law. Or there's Pollyanna's Law, which says he's good in everything and everything's going to be turned out for the best. So really, it's a chapter to remove these statistical misunderstandings and say that there's no natural justice, there's no tendency for bad things or good things to happen. Things happen. They happen. And sometimes they're bad and sometimes they're good. And what's good for one person may be bad for another, of course.
Well, that's a very, very good point, because all the points about, you know, people praying for America to win wars or something, you know,
or tennis players praying to win, as though the other fellow didn't deserve to win as much as they do. Why should God be on my side just because I pray to him?
Well, it depends on how much money you put in the basket every week, okay? That's it. You can buy God's affection. You can't petition him with prayer, but you can buy his affection, okay? There you go. Now, one thing, you know, and I was discussing this with somebody just before we came in, and I was saying, if you read Richard Dawkins' book, you're going to see that, you know, there's this thing that he posits about if you flip a coin 999 times and it's heads all that time, what's the best bet to make on the 1,000th time? And I posed it to the guy, and he fell for it, Richard. He said, heads.
Oh, no, that's right. That's right. Because if he said 999 times heads, then that's a biased penny.
Right, he said tails, and so that's the point.
Oh, he said tails. Okay, then he's definitely wrong. No, if you've tossed a penny 999 times and it's been heads every time, you better bet on heads again.
Exactly, the weighted coin.
Right. Yeah,
the two-headed coin. That's the point. Well, now let's get into this last question, which is extremely important. It brings us right back to where we were in the beginning, but based on everything that we've learned in the book, which is miracles and the existence of miracles, the approach to miracles, all very important. And particularly, you know, as someone who grew up Irish Catholic, you know, everything was a miracle, everything, including getting out of bed in the morning was a miracle, you know. And but there's a and I went to the school, Our Lady of Fatima, you know.
Oh, so, really? My goodness.
Yeah, right. That's what I say. A gentle response there, Richard. But let's talk about this thing of miracles, because it really, that is still something that is so, so out there, so broadly around the world in all kinds of religion. And in, again, almost conventional wisdom.
Yes. Well, I make a distinction between magic spells, as in frogs turning into princes and things like that, and conjuring magic, stage magic, and the magic of reality, the sort of poetic magic. And you can take spells magic, magic spells magic, and divide it into two. Those spells that nobody believes in, like frogs turning into princes, and those spells that people do believe in, like water turning into wine, or a prophet flying to heaven on a winged horse or something like that, or indeed the miracle of Fatima that you mentioned, where the Virgin Mary was supposed to have appeared to three children and promised to come back on the 13th of October, wreak a miracle, and so she is alleged to have done. So a miracle is a magic spell that people believe in. They're not all religious, and some of them are things like ghost stories. A lot of people believe that, say, when somebody dies, their ghost may visit them, or they report spooky coincidences. They dream of somebody in the night, and they haven't thought of him for decades, and then they wake up and discover that he died in the night. A lot of people believe that there's something real about that, that the dying person came and visited them telepathically in their dream or something. So those are what I mean by miracles, as opposed to the plain fairy tale spells like coaches turning into pumpkins. There's absolutely no reason to believe in any miracles. There are all sorts of better ways to explain apparent miracles, and I discuss all of them. They're quite various. Mm-hmm. But miracles don't happen, and if you think that something miraculous has happened, look a bit harder and find out what the true explanation is.
Mm-hmm. And I really like your point where you actually quote David Hume, and you cite him and his work, and you say that, you know, basically you should really judge it like what actually would be more miraculous.
Yes.
You know, and that's an important approach. Yes. And I think also the approach, again, the approach of science, that this something strange happens, it should open doors to push science. And I really like the idea, even positing the idea that it should, even if it means maybe even developing a whole new kind of science off of this.
Yes.
Let me read one final quote, and then you can make a comment, and we'll talk about it. And this, I know, characterizes the entire book, The Magic of Reality, How We Know What's Really True, by Richard Dawkins. Richard, here's the quote. It says, "Truth has a magic of its own. The truth is more magical in the best and most exciting sense of the word than any myth or made-up mystery or miracle. Science has its own magic, the magic of reality."
It is a magical thought to think that here we are on this planet. We exist, we owe our existence to that prodigious series of lucky accidents that I mentioned earlier, plus the non-lucky, the non-random force of evolution by natural selection, which has brought us here. It is wonderful that evolution has given us the gift of life, the gift of sense organs, the gift of eyes to look out at the universe, the gift of ears to hear, the gift of a brain to understand what we see, the gift of a brain to reconstruct what must have happened in the past to give rise to us, the gift of a brain to work out how the universe works, how old the universe is, how the elements came into existence. It is an enormous privilege to live in this world and to be born at a time when so much is understood already, but so much remains to be understood. And so there's a real challenge still remaining to us. I find that a huge privilege. To me, that is the magic of reality.
All right, Richard, thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Talk to you again soon. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. We've just spent the hour talking with Richard Dawkins, ethologist and evolutionary biologist, author, science educator, and humanist. And our conversation centered on his latest book, The Magic of Reality, How We Know What's Really True. And it's put out by Free Press. And now I want to give you a quick message about the California prisoner hunger strike. On October 13th, the Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity website announced that the Pelican Bay Shoe Unit hunger strikers have ended their strike after almost 3 weeks. It said that the prisoners cited a memo from the California Department of Corrections detailing a comprehensive review of every SHU prisoner in California whose SHU sentence is related to gang validation. The last round of the prisoner hunger strike in July also ended after 3 weeks, when the CDCR met with representatives of the strikers and said that they would review their demands. The prisoners resumed the hunger strike on September 26th because the California Department of Corrections had not taken any serious steps towards addressing the prisoners' core demands. The Department of Corrections is now once again promising to review the prisoners' 5 core demands. In this latest round of the strike, prison officials launched a campaign of vicious disciplinary retaliation against and vilification of the hunger strikers. For example, they blocked family visits for hunger strikers, banned the key outside mediators from the prisons, and refused to allow human rights groups or journalists into the prisons to directly investigate conditions and interview the hunger strikers. For all these reasons, it is impossible to fully know the situation that the hunger strikers have been and are facing, and under what conditions the strike at Pelican Bay was ended again. But the website also announced that prisoners at Calipatria State Prison have decided to temporarily end their hunger strike to regain strength. Hunger strikers were subject to extreme retaliation at Calipatria as well, including withholding water and vitamins. Reports from prisoners indicated that many men were collapsing in their cells and that the guards were doing nothing when alerted. Calipatria has virtually no programming for prisoners, and prisoners frequently have nothing in their cells to enrich their days. The prison has prohibited radios and television, which violates CDCR policy. These prisoners continue to face the most brutal, inhumane conditions of torture, and in the face of this, they are waging a tremendously heroic struggle to let the world know about the barbaric U.S. prisons and pressing forward with their demands to be treated like human beings. The support for these prisoners must continue and get even stronger, broader, and more determined. This is a question of our moral responsibility. We must stand with the prisoners and let the world know about the outrageous criminal conditions that they face and the struggle that they're waging. And we've got to demand an immediate halt to the vicious retaliation and punishment that prison officials are bringing down on the prisoner hunger strikers. I want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. I want to thank my production assistants, Henry Carson and Cody James. And I want to thank each and every one of you for continuing to tune in each and every week. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with This Magic Moment from Lou Reed.
This magic moment, so different and so new, was like any other, until I met you, and then it happened.